It's really a great pleasure to have this opportunity to speak with Mark Rubinstein a bit more broadly today. Mark is the author of the wonderful newsletter on financial sector themes, Net Interest. And while we've had quite a few conversations about Mark's articles and insights in the financial sector, Mark, I realized we've never actually had a broader conversation about your path in investing and your investment philosophy. So I'd love to do that. Perhaps we could just start with some background on you and how you came to what you're doing these days.
Well, thanks, John. Great to be here. So I spent 10 years as a partner at a hedge fund firm based in London called Lansdowne Partners. Lansdowne actually is one of the oldest hedge funds in London, long short equity firm. And in mid-2000s, set up a fund that was focused exclusively on financials, long short financials globally. And I joined that fund in 2006. So the fund was launched in 2004. I joined that fund in 2006 and stayed for 10 years. I wound that fund up in 2016 for reasons we can discuss. But I spent a good part of my career looking as an investor at financials globally. Prior to that, I'd been a sell-side analyst. I was at Credit Suisse for 6 years prior to that. I'd been at a couple of other firms in the late 90s before that. All of that time looking at financials. So never grew up wanting to be a banks analyst, but ended up on the graduate training program at a London-based investment bank in the mid-90s and was parachuted in to banks equity research. And so banks are what I learned and banks are what I did initially on the sell side and then ultimately on the buy side as an investor as well.
Interesting. And on the sell side, what were some of the types of banks you covered?
So I initially began, I was quite fortunate actually. I began in 1995 actually at BZW, which is the investment banking subsidiary of Barclays. Ultimately, it was sold to Credit Suisse, but Barclays at the time wanted to be a investment bank, all singing, all dancing, And so I covered for them continental European banks. At the time, the UK desk was distinct from the European desk. I was put on the continental. Interestingly, it was clearly a UK-based firm and the UK market was its bread and butter. We, who were focused on continental European equities, kind of sat in the corner off the main trading floor. But that's where I began. And so I started as an associate working for a analyst who was looking at the French and German banks. I myself was initially given the Scandinavian banks. And this was a very, very interesting time because Scandinavian countries had gone through a banking crisis in the mid-1990s and were beginning to come out of it. Actually, their banks were largely nationalized. And so one of my first jobs as an analyst was to work with the bankers in the privatization of some of those Scandinavian banks. So I worked on those. And we come back to this actually when we talk about the financial crisis of 2007, 2008. But it kind of colored my views on the cycle that banks operate in, which is that there are many, many reasons why they go bust. But studying the Scandinavian banks at the time, I came to understand some of those reasons why banks go bust. But having been recapitalized and then relaunched back into the market, certainly my experience from those Scandinavian banks at that time was that it could be a very, very interesting time for an investor because they write back many of the provisions they'd previously taken to the benefit of the new shareholders that had come in subsequently, in those cases, through privatization. They were underwriting to a much, much better standard than before, and they were hugely capital generative. In the case of those Scandinavian banks as well, they were able to generate additional value through the property investments that they had built up. In many cases, they had accumulated huge real estate portfolios through repossession. In the US, we talk about other real estate owned. These Scandinavian banks built up huge real estate portfolios and generated a lot of value. They spun off, actually, in many cases, those real estate businesses. And so there were kind of three sources for value creation. There was the initial write back of provisions. Then there was the creation of value through the spin-off of these real estate arms. And then, because of very, very strong underwriting, provisions remained low for many, many years, and capital continued to be generated at a very high rate. So the opportunity to invest in those Scandinavian banks at that time was very positive. And as I say, it kind of colored my views, but we'll come back and talk about that later. But it was a very interesting space to be focused on. And that's what I did. And then subsequently, actually, I was involved in many other privatizations of banks. For example, Credit Lyonnais, which in France similarly had gone through a crisis and had to be bailed out by its government. And then, in addition, many of the Eastern European banks. Obviously, we're looking at a time of convergence in the late 90s between many Eastern European markets and the developed markets of Western Europe. And there were many kind of privatization opportunities in Hungary, Poland as well, which I participated in as an equity analyst.
Interesting. And then when did you make the switch to Lansdowne?
So that was in 2006. So basically, I, like many sell side analysts, had always hankered after a move to the buy side. I understood that it was something at some stage in my career I wanted to do, but I was very particular about the type of firm, the type of investing platform that I wanted to work with. So coming from the background as an analyst, it had to be, from my perspective, fundamental orientated firm. Long short, I really liked the opportunity of working with a short book. That's something we can talk about. It's very different from working with a long book, but from the mindset of a fundamental oriented analyst who, even in the early 2000s, for example, in Germany, there were some very, very clear short opportunities which I'd arrived on as a sell side analyst. I saw the canvas was much bigger on a long short, and the idea of working towards absolute return also appealed intellectually as well. So for those reasons, I wanted to work at a hedge fund, long short. I wanted to work at one which had more of a fundamental analytical orientation. And there were various firms, and obviously the benefit I had as a sell side analyst was that they were all my clients. And so I became quite close to the people at Lansdowne as clients. And in 2006, it would be easy to look back with hindsight and say that was ideal timing to move from the sell side to the buy side. Obviously, at the time, I think there is a paper trail of me in 2006 on the sell side, having identified some problems emerging in the banking sector broadly around leverage, not around subprime, but around excessive leverage in the banking system. But that wasn't the reasons why I moved to the buy side. But nevertheless, the right firm came along. It was a great fit from personnel perspective. I got on with the people at Lansdowne. And so I made that move in 2006, kind of spring 2006.
Well, certainly prescient timing there. And did Lansdowne set up a fund, or how did that work in terms of what you were actually focused on there?
Yeah, so Lansdowne actually was established in 98, and initially it was a single strategy hedge fund focused on Europe. The idea being that the portfolio manager came over from Harvard to run the Lansdowne European Fund. The idea being that back in 1998, there was a lot of opportunity in Europe linked to convergence and the emergence as well of shareholder value culture in Europe, which hadn't really existed before then. So that was the strategy that was in place in 98. 2001, a UK fund was launched. Some very successful investment managers came over from Mercury Asset Management, which subsequently became part of Merrill Lynch. I joined in 2006 to work alongside a fund which itself had launched in 2004. So the Lansdowne Global Financials Fund had launched in 2004. The portfolio manager who launched it had a similar background to my own. He came from Morgan Stanley as a sell-side European banks analyst. I joined him from Credit Suisse as a sell-side European banks analyst, and we ran it subsequently from 2006, but the fund had been launched in 2004.
And how did you think about portfolio construction there in terms of concentration on the long side and then how you actually implemented trades on the short side?
It's a really good question, and one I get a lot from sell-side analysts who are starting out on their careers, what the differences are between the sell side and the buy side, and how one makes that jump. And the way I would categorize it is that on the, and this was a shock to me, it took me a while to really internalize, is that on the buy side as an investor, one is managing a portfolio. Whereas on the sell side, it's kind of a series of individual stocks. So on the sell side, and it's one dimensional on the sell side, is it buy or is it sell? Actually, in many cases, less so now, but back then it was, is it buy or is it hold? And it was kind of one dimensional in that sense. And one's view on one stock didn't really have a bearing on one's view on another stock. As an investor managing a portfolio, it's multidimensional. And so as well as the kind of core recommendation, the stock picking element to it, there are kind of two other dimensions. One is sizing, which is really important. And some analysis we did, and I'm not alone here. I mean, every investor will know this, that the number of individual loss-making positions can actually be quite high, higher than certainly a sell-side analyst might accept. As long as the sizing on the profitable positions is high enough. And many investors before, and actually I did a back of the envelope analysis back in 2006, just after I joined, and it was kind of 55% loss making, 45% profit making, but the sizing around those profit making positions was very, very important. We typically had a kind of 10% cap. That was a risk management constraint we imposed on ourselves. Others will have different levels of tolerance. But then the other dimension is correlation as well, particularly when one is working in a single sector strategy. The idea of correlation is very important as well. So being long Bank of America and being long Citigroup, for example, it was true back then. It's maybe a little bit less true today, but as true today, has correlation implications on the overall portfolio. Now, the huge advantage we had back then is that the banking sector, or I should say the financials sector globally, was particularly uncorrelated. So we had exchanges. Exchanges were IPOing, demutualizing at around that time. MasterCard and Visa came to the market 2005, between 2005, 2008. Very, very different kind of dynamics to those of a bank. We had Chinese banks, which were IPOing, and emerging market banks more generally, which were IPOing and offering growth, which we weren't getting out of American regional banks. We had, we can come on and talk about this, but we had subprime, kind of monoline, subprime mortgage originators in the US, very different dynamics. So the dynamics around banks, the opportunities on the long side and the short side were vast, and correlation was very, very low, because at the time this was a bottom-up driven sector, which offered restructuring in some cases. It offered recovery. I was speaking before about the Scandinavian banks, but there were other banks around the world which were coming out of downturns. So they offered recovery. So we had restructuring, we had in Europe, we had recovery, we had downside. We can talk about this around subprime. We had growth from emerging markets. We kind of had all the factors. We didn't use that term then. People now talk about the term factors. We had all of those factors alive and kicking in one sector. So the ability to craft a portfolio that was with constituents that were uncorrelated, that we could size appropriately, the opportunities were immense.
So let's talk about the financial crisis, or how you perhaps went into that, and then what you did during the crisis, because the financial sector obviously was very much at the epicenter of that.
That's exactly right. And I say, you know, I clearly had a ringside seat on the financial crisis, simply because it began on the balance sheet of financial institutions. And my job was to analyze the balance sheets of financial institutions. And I was unconflicted in that. Clearly, there were analysts at Moody's and Standard & Poor's who had the same job, but they were conflicted. There were analysts at sell-side investment firms who had the same job, but they were conflicted given the amount of banking activity that was prevalent at the time. Being global was a huge advantage as well to me. So actually, having looked at European banks exclusively prior to that move to the sell side, one of the first things that I did was go and look at the US, kind of immerse myself, study the US financial system, and look very, very closely at these subprime lenders, which were high growth. But they were showing in 2006, they were posting even in August of 2006, they began posting early payment defaults. It was very curious, kind of as a European based mortgage borrower myself, the idea that one would take a mortgage and then default within 90 days of taking that mortgage was curious and got me pulling on the thread. And it became apparent in 2006, so we were short many of these subprime lenders going from 2006 into 2007, this kind of curiosity that underwriting had got a little bit too loose, that there was something going on. There was a machine that had to be fed, and that actually you could see as well, there was a lot of M&A in that space. A lot of the investment banks who were benefiting, who were sitting at the back end of that machine on the securitization side, were vertically integrating by buying some of these subprime mortgage originators as well. This whole value chain was a source of immense interest to me and the team. And it became apparent that something was going on that wasn't necessarily sustainable. And so we started to pull at the thread. And the benefit of being global as well is then by pulling on the thread, we then traced it back to Europe. So it became then kind of in 2007, it became clear to us anyway, that a lot of the assets that were being originated in the US were finding their way back onto balance sheets of European and Chinese financial institutions. And kind of having that global mandate from an investment perspective allowed us to, on the short side, exploit that.
And then you, I guess, were short in 2006, how did you kind of manage that short? Because I believe those companies still did okay through 2007 at some point. Is that right?
Yeah, it was. So we managed. So typically we were net long. So our portfolio construction was to be broadly net long. The opportunities on the long side were also immense in 2006 and 2007, actually. So we were able to, so we weren't net short, and we were able to perform on that basis. The challenges actually came a bit later. And at the time, the kind of volatility of those stocks was such that we were able to absorb that volatility. The challenges came later, actually. The challenges came in August of 2007, the so-called meltdown in quant funds was a challenge in kind of August 2007. But the real challenges came later in 2008, where we hadn't really had short squeezes in the sector up until then. But I specifically remember in the summer of 2008, a massive short squeeze around the banks. I mean, we're kind of going ahead of ourselves. I don't know how much detail you want to go into this, but we're kind of beyond Bear Stearns now, but pre-Lehman. We're in that period. There was that window, 6 months post the collapse of Bear Stearns, but pre the collapse of Lehman, where it was interesting actually to know what the market thought was going on then. There was, in that summer, so the summer of 2007, where we'd seen this hedge fund meltdown, there was a famous quote at the time, David Vinier, who was the CFO of Goldman Sachs, said about the summer of 2007, he called it a 25 standard deviation event, which, as any kind of statistician knows, is a remarkably infrequent occurrence that wouldn't have been likely to have happened in our lifetimes as investors, but that's how he characterized it. We went through that. We had this kind of window, the six-month window between Bear Stearns and Lehman, which was kind of curious. It was in that summer, there was almost like a stay of execution. It was almost like a ceasefire in that summer, such that it wasn't until we came back after the holidays on Labor Day in 2008 with Fannie and Freddie, and there's lots of detail here, we can go into however much you want, things really started to go wrong. But the squeezes, the short squeezes that would happen in that period, and then subsequently in October 2008, when regulators came in and imposed short selling bans, that's when things became tricky for a short seller. But prior to that, there were opportunities on the long side and the short side, and portfolio management and portfolio construction wasn't that different from the years that had gone on prior to that.
Interesting. And then when those short selling bans came, how did you respond to that? Or were you still able to express the short view in other ways?
Very interesting, actually. It became, I can't pretend we had the insight immediately, but the insight was simple. The insight was actually the fundamental case for these shorts is as compelling as it had been. But holding that short was a more valuable resource than it had been, because the opportunity to put on new shorts was now diminished. We could maintain our existing shorts. We simply couldn't put on new shorts. Other funds that were more constrained, maybe they were less fundamental, they had volatility constraints that they had to maintain, were forced to cover. And so the value of our shorts was actually enhanced. So it was a painful period, kind of October 2008, but the value of those shorts was actually enhanced. And that, as I say, it's not an insight we can pretend to have had immediately, but it was a clear insight that we ultimately benefited from.
Tell us a little bit about how then the dominoes started falling and how you responded or acted upon that.
So again, so going back, so initially it was subprime. Initially, the first domino was subprime, which we saw we were short. So there was a company we were short going into 2007 called New Century, which was and I went to a conference in Florida in January, it might have been December 2006, January 2007, and this company was presenting. And it was kind of reminded me, actually, I'd been to a tech conference back in beginning of 2000, and that kind of sense of euphoria before the dot-com bubble collapsed, that kind of sense of euphoria, this was a tech conference that I attended. The kind of euphoria that was present there, I could see it in Florida amongst these subprime originators in the beginning of 2007. It's kind of a sense that this was our time, this was a new era, and they just couldn't process the demand they had for mortgage quickly enough. There are stories, you know, clearly The Big Short talks about Steve Eisman famously went to visit in Florida some of these home building developments and speak to new mortgage borrowers, people who are buying multiple homes as investors. I didn't do that, but arrived at a similar insight through a different means. And so initially, so the first domino was these subprime originators. So we were short New Century. February 2007, actually, it declared a loss. Actually, HSBC was the next domino, actually. HSBC had bought a mortgage company in America called Household for a very high price. I can't remember the year, a few years prior to that. They profit warned. I remember this well because I was actually in India. I was looking at some Indian financials in February of 2007, doing a tour of India, looking at some of those financials. And we got this news about the HSBC profit warning from there. And that had a knock-on impact. Some of our other holdings, we were short in subprime at the time. So that was one domino. And then it moved very quickly. It moved to European. So there was a non-quoted European bank, German bank, IKB, and there were some of the other German banks, and we saw it. So the dominoes fell actually out of the US into Europe very, very quickly, more quickly than I think people, such that it wasn't a subprime, crisis. People get, looking back, I'm not sure when people stopped referring to it as a subprime crisis, but given the impact it had in Europe and the spotlight it put on the leverage, remember I said earlier that my job was to study banks and financial companies' balance sheets, and the leverage they were holding was very, very high. They've been able to sustain very high ROEs in spite of lower margins because of rising leverage. And so that was another observation we'd had. And those things kind of came together in the realization that this wasn't just a subprime crisis and it had broader implications. And so the dominoes were, and actually an observation we had coming out of the crisis and moving forward very, very quickly now to the first quarter of 2009. So the first quarter of 2000, so the observation we had coming out of the crisis was that those that went into the crisis early were those that ones came out first. And so the investment banks, the brokers, Goldman Sachs in particular, and some of the Chinese banks, which the Bank of China became exposed very early through its holdings of mortgage-backed securities. In the first quarter of 2009, I talked earlier about portfolio construction. That was a phenomenal, almost unique period to be a long short. There was a period like it in 2007, but the first quarter of 2009 was very special for long short financials investing, because on the long side, to be long some Chinese banks, which were coming out of this very, very quickly, and they were aided by Chinese fiscal support, but also the likes of Goldman performed very, very well. But on the short side, there were still banks that were lagging, had denied that they needed to raise capital. I went to a conference at the beginning of 2009. Vikram Pandit was the CEO of Citi at the time, and he was in denial still that he needed to raise equity. His view was that preferred equity was pari passu with common, tangible. The view of the market was that it wasn't. And Citi had to raise a lot of capital. So, and Citi went down to, it's had a consolidation, a share, reverse share split since then. But at the time, it went down to below a dollar a share, which is equivalent to below $10 a share now, I think. So that was a very interesting time. So the dominoes, so I'm answering the question in a slightly different way. This was the dominoes actually stacking themselves back up again in reverse in the first quarter of 2009, which was an interesting time. I should say it wasn't all, I've painted a picture of success. It wasn't all successful. And actually I referred earlier to having been colored by the Scandinavian banking crisis of 1995, 1996. And we did have the opportunity in 2007 to invest in a failing US bank called National City, which is now part of PNC. And we took that opportunity, thinking at the time that this capital injection that we were providing would be the last capital injection it needed. And that we could benefit from its recovery, and that was clearly too early. So it wasn't all successful, but that's hopefully paints a little bit of a picture about some of the opportunities on the long side and the short side that were available at that time.
Absolutely, and of course it must have been very challenging if you're running a net long strategy in that kind of environment in the financial sector to not be somehow affected by what was going on. Mark, when it comes to kind of, and I'll just now fast forward quite a lot, but when you look at the banks and their positioning coming out of that crisis versus today, how would you characterize the intervening period in terms of the balance sheets, the prudence, and kind of where the banks are today in terms of just, you know, strength and stability?
So they're clearly very strong now. I think there's been some wobbles along the way. There was a wobble at the beginning of 2016. There was a wobble clearly in March of 2020 when coronavirus hit, and there was a suspicion that banks at the time would suffer a lot of non-performing loans. Again, there's a playbook. It's actually interesting. I remember coming out of the crisis and I was wrong. My understanding coming out of the crisis, the global financial crisis, 2009, 2010, and again, it may have been colored by my experiences in Scandinavia, is that there'd be a recovery that would be swift, and it would be very profitable for bank investors. I was told at the time by a tech strategist who had experienced the dot-com boom and bust in 1999-2000. He said, no, you've been way too optimistic. Such as the pain that's been caused, it takes a whole generation of investors to forget before the sector can recover. And that was his experience from tech in kind of 2000. And I thought, well, financials are a bit different because they're inherently more leveraged. And so the upside can be more dramatic. And so I considered what he said, but I kind of dismissed it. He was right. And I think the reason, and we saw that subsequently. So whenever there was a wobble in the 10 years subsequent to the crisis, the kind of financial crisis playbook was reached for by investors every time. People would look at CDS spreads to understand as a read for what that might mean for equity prices of financial institutions. People would talk about capital increases and in Europe, rights issues whenever a bank was to make a loss of some sort. And in some cases, that was too pessimistic, like in the beginning of 2016 and also in March of 2020. But one thing is very, very clear is that the leverage that I spoke about earlier, clearly banks don't have it to any extent that they had it back then today. They've raised a lot of capital since. They are a lot more resilient, but, which is all positive, and the bull case, if you like, should have been, could have been, maybe still is, that the cost of equity for banks should be lower because the volatility of their returns should be lower, given more resilient balance sheets. But the bear case is twofold. One is regulation, maybe threefold actually, two of which were obvious. One crept a lot, one kind of pounced on investors that weren't looking, which I'll describe in a second. But the two obvious ones were, one, regulation was just immense and went on for a very long time. There are still regulations coming out of Basel that haven't actually even been signed into law yet. So it's still ongoing. So regulation was just immense. And two is, it was interest rates went to zero. And the impact that has on banks is and has been very, very negative for their profits. The thing that came along that maybe people weren't anticipating is technology. And this is something I've spent a lot of time looking at over the past few years. One of the reasons why technology solutions have been able to make such an impact in the financials sector is because of regulation. So regulation always creates unintended consequences. And one of those has been to allow technology a entry into the financial services sector. So, you know, we can go on and talk about this if you like, but clearly right now, and it's very topical right now, given the amount of IPOs that are coming around out of fintech. But a lot of them actually got their head start because of the immense regulations that were imposed on financials kind of coming out of the crisis.
Well, that's a great point. And I think you wrote about that as well. And Jamie Dimon, I believe, has lamented this, that really the regulation has put banks and financial institutions at a big disadvantage as compared to technology companies that have been able to innovate a lot more with a lot fewer constraints.
Yeah, that's right. So Jamie Dimon's been quite vocal about it. He has said that financial regulation has been kind of unjoined, that he was very critical about this, actually going back many, many years, that regulators don't necessarily speak to each other and that it would always have unintended consequences. And one of those absolutely has been allowing technology companies. So technology companies themselves will say, oh, you know, we offer better technology. Famously, Bill Gates said back in the 1990s, you know, we need banking, but we don't need banks. And a lot of technology companies have exploited that as a narrative, but the underlying entry point, I think, has been around regulation. And actually, there was a paper, an academic paper written a number of years ago, which looked at the US mortgage market. And it concluded that, so just to give you the background, in 2010, 90% of US mortgages were originated by banks. So Wells Fargo had a 25% market share of the US mortgage market. Bank of America had a large share as well. And Chase had a big share. Between them, they had over 50% of the market. Today, the US banks have 25% of the US mortgage market. 75% of US mortgage market today is non-banks, which in many cases offer technology solutions, online platforms like Rocket or Quicken Loans, same thing, and so on and so forth. The academic study a few years ago concluded that actually half of the growth of these non-banks has come from regulations, that regulations imposed on banks required them to exit the market, and that paved the way for these non-banks. So half, actually about 60% of the growth of these non-banks, so the increase in market share from 10% all the way up to 75%, 60% of that has come from regulation, and only 30% from kind of better technology. So, and that's true. We see it everywhere. There's a company IPOing right now called Marqeta, which basically offers financial institutions and non-financial institutions a platform to issue cards, debit cards or credit cards. And debit cards in particular, in the US, there are two levels of regulation around what fees can be captured on debit cards, depending on how big a financial institution you are. So if you're smaller than $10 billion of assets, the fees can be over 100 basis points. If you are bigger than 10 billion of assets, the fees are below 100 basis points, actually very, very low. And these kind of constraints generate loopholes and generate regulatory arbitrage opportunities, which we are seeing in payments in that sense right now. We've seen it in mortgage, and we're seeing it in all other areas as well. And they're being exploited quite cheaply through technology by non-banks.
So when you look at the future of bank business models, what's your take on the profitability of those in light of the many challenges from fintech? Let's say interest rates do come back up a bit and it becomes a more normal environment for banks, but yet you have fintechs like Revolut, let's say, in the UK that seem to be just taking a lot of a share from consumers.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think right now, there's two answers to that. So firstly, if rates, and it comes back to rates and regulation, actually, which were the two big strangleholds on bank profitability over the past few years. If rates go up, then banks will be fine. They've got cheap, they've got a unique source of cheap deposits, which create value in a rate environment which is higher than where we are now. So higher rates, banks will be profitable again. The other side of that, though, is on the impact of the non-banks, the challenger banks, whatever it might be. And some of this is sustainable. So banking is interesting because it's one of the last vertically integrated industries out there. It's got a vertically integrated value chain. There aren't that many other industries out there where the same institution will have stores on the high street, will meet with consumers, retail customers on the high street, and all the way back through the value chain, do all the manufacturing, do all the design, do everything involved with that product. But banking is one of those, particularly in Europe, maybe less so in the US, where asset management industry has been divorced from banking industry for a long time. And what we're seeing, what technology is doing, is it's removing some of the frictions. It's allowing for the modularization and the breakup of that value chain. And some of the kind of super apps are demonstrating that they just sit, kind of the analogy would be, on the high street. They've got the best real estate, which is the consumer smartphone, but they're not doing any of the manufacturing stuff. Banks historically have done it all. So that is a challenge. That's a threat, which is maybe the bear case, if you like. The bull case is that regulators are kind of on the case, and that banks, and there's not a level playing field. So banks will argue, comes back to Jamie Dimon, banks will argue there's not a level playing field out there, that technology companies have an advantage. For now, regulators are kind of okay with that, as long as 90% of banking, of financial services, is in the regulated banking system. But as soon as that 90%, there's a kind of tipping point, and when we go through that tipping point, then regulatory scrutiny will hone in on the non-banks, and that's kind of a threat. And when I talk to a lot of fintech founders, a lot of fintech investors, and there is this, how kind of well internalized it is, I don't know, but certainly it feels to me that there's a point at which regulation for those entities becomes a lot more important, and the cost of regulation can become very significant once they get above a certain size.
Where you have quite a lot of experience with fintech, and I know you've also been an investor in some fintech companies. Where are you seeing the most interesting innovations taking place that maybe, those of us that are just looking at S1s and the public markets may not be aware of yet?
Well, there's a lot of new lending opportunities, I think. There are pockets of lending. There are types of lending that banks historically have never done. So banks typically have done kind of collateral-based lending, but there are various opportunities now using data to form predictive models on revenues that companies may generate. And there are models, not dissimilar to merchant cash advance, where financial institutions can take first claim on some of those revenues, having predicted what they, and having great visibility through data to understand what they might be. So the various models kind of lending around marketing, lending around consumer acquisition, various kind of lending models on the payroll, and again changing maybe there's a legacy construct whereby employees are paid, it's kind of a different example, but there's a legacy construct whereby employees are paid, whether it's bi-weekly or in the case of Europe, monthly. And so employers have an advantage there because obviously the labor is accruing on a kind of daily, minute by minute basis, but payment only has to be made on a kind of monthly basis. And so there are opportunities to close up that gap and offer employees kind of minute by minute payment or daily payment, for example. So whether it's opportunities to create new loans or to or create more kind of real time opportunities, those are some of the opportunities. But you mentioned public markets, John. I mean, I think what's interesting as well is there's a lot of it's not all good. It's this kind of notion that banking is a dinosaur and fintech is the new big thing. It's not to say that every fintech model is going to be successful. And we've seen failures even in the public markets already. So marketplace lenders came to the market in 2016. We saw insurance companies, insurtech companies come last year in 2020, and they haven't been successful particularly yet. So not to say that it's very, clearly, like any bottom-up investor, it's important to look at the underlying dynamics of the individual business case.
And to what extent do you believe that innovation can happen within banks, or is it just so that the cultures are typically just not congruent with the kind of fast-paced product innovation that's needed?
It's difficult. They're big. It would be true. It would be a problem for any large organization that hadn't emerged kind of in this generation of technology. And that's not true just for the banking system. So it makes it difficult. They're very, very big, and they have to be compliant from a regulatory perspective. Many of them have grown through acquisition. So they have legacy systems which don't necessarily speak to one another. Data isn't clean and it sits in various different silos. So just being new has advantages. Just having a infrastructure that's built on a modern platform has huge advantages. So yeah, it's a problem for the banks.
And Mark, you mentioned you had been at Lansdowne through 2016. Tell us what you're up to since then and how you spend your time these days.
So I wound the phone up in 2016, wanted to take some time off. I'd actually always fancied going back to university. I'd never did an MBA. I did a mathematics undergraduate degree and went straight with that into banking. Never did an MBA, never did any other further studying. Kind of always fancied it. Was aware that I'd always focused actually on financials and that given this changing world, that it will be a useful opportunity to learn some other skills, maybe data science, maybe just some other disciplines from other industries. And so I signed up to London Business School and did an MBA actually in my kind of mid-40s. Slightly different. It was the Sloan program at the London Business School, which was a great opportunity. Actually, through that as well, I got the opportunity to fly out to Omaha and meet Warren Buffett as part of one of those schemes, which he stopped doing actually subsequently. I think I may have been the last cohort where he invited business school students to come and meet him in quite small groups in Omaha. And he stopped doing that subsequently. But that was an interesting opportunity. And actually, he said something at the time, which was very poignant about lifelong learning and about as one gets older, one becomes more intelligent about other people and just wiser, I guess. Something he said before, but kind of in a room full of 26-year-old MBAs. He kind of felt like he was talking to me as one of the oldest in the room. So that was interesting. So I spent a year studying, which was great. I came out of that and started kind of investing on my own account, doing some work with financial institutions and fintech companies in particular, and investing as an angel investor in fintech. And then, as you know, started this newsletter a year ago, May of 2020, called Net Interest. About just really wanting to write down some of my thoughts on the industry, get them out there. And so that's what I've been doing since. So it's a combination of the writing, investing both in private markets and in public markets around financials, and also doing some advisory work.
Well, the newsletter has been terrific, and I know the audience of it has grown tremendously. I can imagine you've received quite a bit of inbound inquiries because of it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That is right. It's a great and also again, just to this point about continually learning. So I grown up, maybe it's my generation, but I kind of grown up, maybe it's a sell side influence actually, conditioned around this kind of scarcity mindset that it's that it's very. I think I've written about this in the context of investment banking, this idea of the zero-sum game. And it's true, and it's less true on the buy side, but it was very, very true kind of in the investment banking world. But this idea, and it's only through experience, the idea that I'm putting something out there, it is free, what I'm putting out there, and that it creates kind of this it creates feedback, and it's been very eye-opening to me. And I know other value investors have gone on a similar journey. The idea, this transition from scarcity to abundance, because there's a lot of analytical resource out there. It used to be behind paywalls. It's less so now. There's a lot of information clearly out there, but to put more of it out there has benefits to me, which were very difficult ex ante to kind of understand what they are, but it's been just incredible just kind of seeing it and appreciating it.
Yeah, I think anyone who's on Twitter and active there, and I know you are, probably has realized over the last few years how much one can gain through this kind of open exchange with others who are on a similar quest of knowledge and wisdom.
Exactly.
Well, Mark, this has been truly terrific. Is there anything we haven't touched on that you'd like to mention?
No, I think that's it. Actually, you know, I'm around. I'm accessible. I'm on via Twitter, as you just mentioned. You know, hopefully, we haven't dwelled too much on the financial crisis, which now is it still casts a very, very long shadow, but it was 12 years ago now, so it's quite a long time. I'm available, and I love talking about financials.
Terrific. Well, I look forward to our continuing conversations about some of the essays and articles you write as part of Net Interest. Always enjoy those very much. Thank you so much, Mark, for your time today.
Thanks, John.